Well, here we are. End of May. Summer's gonna be good, we know that. But what about, like, October, November? You thinking about that yet? Because we are. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 28th of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Summer starts unofficially anyway this weekend, so you might think things would be slowing down. Economic news would be ebbing, and we would all be getting ready for a nice, slow couple of months. If you thought that, you would be wrong. Lots happening this week and lots happening in the next couple of weeks and months, Ed. So let us discuss. Neela Richardson is at ADP. Lynette Lopez is at Business Insider. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
I say everybody. It's really just the three of us. Okay, so look, Neela, let me start with you. And I will preface the question by observing that the White House today, as expected, dropped the president's budget request for the coming fiscal year. $6 trillion-ish. A lot of money. We'll get into that. I do want to talk, though, about his projections, the White House economists' projections, really, for economic growth in the out years. 2%, which is not as robust as, say, the prior administration had been thinking the economy would grow. Why do you think they're being conservative like that?
Because it's the truth, actually. It's the gravitational. I know, truth. But it is the gravitational pull of the economy. Look, let's set aside the post-pandemic recovery, mm-hmm. because that's a story in itself. 10 years of expansion before the pandemic was at an average pace of 2.3%. The power of that longest expansion in U.S. history had been its slow growth, low inflation characteristics. Mm-hmm. Once we get through this recovery, that's exactly right back to where we're going. Slow growth in the out years at around 2%, and even further out, maybe 1.5%. That is the trajectory, unless we make some interesting investments that will pay off long term.
All right. Well, wait, we're going to get back to the investments in a minute. But Lynette, I want to point out that $6 trillion, first of all, is a lot of money. Also, this budget calls for annual deficits, right? That's the amount of money we're short every single year, of $1.3 trillion for like another 10 years, which is a lot of bonds that are going to have to be sold. Are people going to want to keep on buying our debt if we're just piling it on like this?
That remains to be seen. But so far, the answer has been yes. And, I think that the Fed and the White House are both very confident that the answer will continue to be yes. They're betting that yields will continue to be low and that we'll continue to borrow. But I just don't think they're concerned about that. The concern to them is whether or not they can pass this stuff, whether they can get the Republicans to stop talking about, how are we going to pay for it, while at the same time saying we can't raise taxes. Yeah. It's a very confusing little two-step those guys are doing. But no, it doesn't seem that concerning that the rest of the world will stop buying U.S. debt.
I don't want to get into the weeds of the Fed's balance sheet, Neela, and all of that stuff. But the Fed has been and will be, if you take Jay Powell at his word, because we do, providing support for this economy for a very long time. This budget kind of assumes that that's going to keep on going.
Well, that has been the messaging that the Fed has lined up behind, that the support will continue, though you're starting to see some fraying around the edges mm-hmm. with some of the members of the Fed president community talking right. about the idea of like dialing back a little bit on bond purchases. But the support at the top with Jay Powell has been a commitment to rock bottom interest rates and continued bond buying to support the economy through the recovery, and also recognize that certain communities have been more impacted than others. And so even as the macro economy continues to recover, there are some communities, African-American right. unemployment rate comes to mind, that need a longer term assistance. And it sounds like the Fed is more and more likely to keep that positioning so that everyone enjoys that recovery.
Right. And that's what said. He's going to let the economy run hot so that everybody, even the bottom end of the income spectrum, can benefit. Lynette, let me turn to inflation here for a second. And I don't want to get all Larry Summers here and the sky is falling.
Please don't.
I'm not going to. And that will be the last mention of him on this program for quite a while next week. We're talking to Muhammad Al-Arian next week and we're going to talk about Summers then. But
oh, that's cool.
Yeah, no, it's going to be a good conversation. But I do want to talk about inflation, not this summer, right? Because we know pent-up demand, supply chain backlogs, and all of that stuff, prices are going up. We've been talking about that. Talk to me about inflation come like October, November, when a lot of this stuff is through the pipeline and we're back to something near normal. What are you thinking?
Well, it looks like the market's not that worried about inflation. Yeah, no, it looks like the market thinks this is transitory. And it looks like the market is actually pretty optimistic about what this is going to look like when things shake out. We still have an economy that is, you know, the wealthy have way more purchasing power than the middle class and the people on the bottom. And that has created a dislocation that I think is a thing that, and a lot of economists think, is what's really putting pressure on inflation and keeping interest rates low. So it's quite possible that we'll be back to where we were with low interest rates when this is all over. And I think that's what a lot of people on Wall Street think. But, you know, you've got inflation hawks, people, right. You know, going back to the 1970s makes a lot of these guys feel young. So I think so sometimes I think that's you know, why they do that. But it's more likely that the gravitational pull of our demography, that is more likely to keep rates low.
Neela, let me ask you this. As the trained economist in the room, and as you navigate an economy which is, honestly, it's a little bit haywire, right? Because we were shut down for a long time and now we're coming back and there's pent up demand and all of that stuff. How do you look at this and try to forecast? I mean, because the models are a little bit sideways.
They are, and they don't always reveal what you need about the health of the economy. And I think we're in this odd moment, Kai, where we can be more confident about the economy after September than we can this summer. Because after September, we're getting closer to that mystical level of herd immunity, more adults vaccinated, kids vaccinated, and important for women's labor market participation, we'll have hopefully full-time daycare and childcare. So things look actually brighter when things are fully reopened. I think this is a murky period where we really don't know where things stand. Lynette mentioned the inequality that's present. We think this inflation is transitory, but there are some rising price levels. And we don't know whether fading stimulus, remember all those direct payments to consumers in March, whether that effect will fade over time and actually dampen some of the consumer spending. And circling back to the key theme of the economy, it's all about the consumers. If they stop spending or start saving more, the economy just doesn't grow as fast.
Right. And that is the September-October piece of this. Neela Richardson at ADP and Lynette Lopez at Business Insider. Thanks, you two.
Thank you, Kai.
Bye, Kai.
Have a nice week. And on Wall Street today, that old saying, sell in May and go away. Yeah, that's not what people did. Details, numbers, you know the drill. All right, we talked a little bit there right at the end, Neela and Lynette and I did, about how everybody is, as usual, banking on consumers, right, to keep opening their wallets and driving this economy, about which we did get some new numbers today. The Bureau of Economic Analysis says that consumer spending ticked up 0.5% last month, and best guesses are that we are going to keep on going right through the summer. But to the theme of the program today, then what happens? What do you suppose consumer spending might be like, say, on a Friday this coming October? We asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer to get out the crystal ball.
Peter Kotradimos knows exactly what he'll be doing this October, spending on fun stuff.
I know we'll be traveling and I know we'll be seeing at least a concert.
This fall, Kotradimos and his family will travel from their home near Phoenix to Mexico.
You know, all this pent-up demand that you've been hearing about, I'm saying we're revving up.
Kotradimos has more than a passing interest here. He's actually an economics professor at Central Arizona College. Lydia Bosour is also an economist at Oxford Economics. And yep, she'll be spending this summer on a trip to Spain. But this fall,
we're likely to see a cool down in consumer spending as consumers and the economy put the pandemic behind. we're likely to see some normalization.
But Basur is still predicting consumer spending will increase almost 10% this year, the strongest since 1946, and she expects consumption to grow 5% next year. Economist Wendy Edelberg at the Brookings Institution is also anticipating strong spending for the rest of the year, but she sees risks. If this were October, Edelberg says, she'd tell me to watch for signs of strain from all that consumer demand.
Whether or not we're seeing stresses in the labor market, in production, in inventories, and what's going on with imports, what's going on with inflation, there will be a lot of signs flashing yellow and perhaps even red.
Edelberg is planning some business travel this fall, with the caveat that if there's a COVID resurgence, she'll be on Zoom. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Trying to run a restaurant at the height of a pandemic, you can't seat people inside or even at all, probably. What do you do? One thing that was a lifeline for a lot of bars and restaurants this past year, alcohol to go. It's legal in 39 states, and a lot of them have or are making takeout drinks permanent, even as things start to get back to or close to normal. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has more on that.
This weekend, Nancy Bambera at DZ Restaurants is banking on a classic pairing, Memorial Day and barbecue.
And you can pair it with a bucket of beer, or you can pair it with a bottle of wine.
Themed to-go meals have been really popular at her restaurants in Saratoga Springs, New York, during the pandemic. And even though capacity restrictions have mostly lifted, takeout makes up 20% of the restaurant group's sales, compared to 2% pre-pandemic.
Which is why it's really important that restaurants be allowed to continue alcoholic beverages to go.
That's Mike Watley at the National Restaurant Association. He says the takeout trend is here to stay, and restaurants can't afford to lose high-margin alcohol profits. Permanent laws have now passed in 13 states, with bills active in at least 6 others. The rules vary, some requiring food purchases, drink limits, and tamper-proof containers, because open container laws don't mean main streets are becoming Bourbon Street. Still,
2020 was the most important year for alcohol since the end of Prohibition.
Jarrett Dieterle researches alcohol regulation at R Street, a policy think tank. He thinks these laws could pave the way to make it easier for distilleries and breweries to ship across state lines.
You know, me in Virginia can get my favorite IPA from a craft brewery in rural northern Michigan.
It's something wine lovers have been able to do for years. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
I do think that beer thing is totally unfair, by the way. Just saying. All right, look, if you miss us on the radio or on the stream, listen to us on your own time, would you? We've got a podcast. You can check it out, marketplace.org or your favorite platform. Coming up.
I've never been busier, oddly enough, finding new ways of working.
The grind never stops, am I right? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 64 points today, almost 0.2%, 34,529. The NASDAQ picked up 12 points, about a 0.1%, 13,748. The S&P 500 basically flat, 42.4. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow added 1.9%. The NASDAQ went the other way, down 1.5%. The S&P 500 gained a little bit more than 0.5%. As of this weekend, summer vacation and road trip season is upon us. How about a look at gas prices? As of today, a gallon of regular is going to run you $3.04 on average. That is, of course, according to AAA, up 16 cents a gallon over a month ago, $1.08 a gallon more than it cost a year ago. Boeing has stopped delivery of 787 Dreamliners. That's according to the Wall Street Journal. That after suspending work on them for 5 months due to, and this is a quote, production problems. Shares in Boeing down 1.4%. Ulta Beauty beat expectations in the first quarter as Americans started emerging from our bunkers and raised sales estimates for the rest of this year. Shares in Ulta picked up 5.1%. Bonds up, yields down 1.58%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Come Tuesday, you know, it's June, and so rent is going to be due. And after more than a year of this pandemic, millions of people have fallen behind. Congress has appropriated almost $50 billion in rental assistance to help those folks out with their rent. As yet unclear, though, is where that money is. Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports.
The money is just starting to make its way to tenants and landlords.
Communities are in different places across the country.
Ann Oliva is with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. She says it's taken time for states, cities, counties, and nonprofits to get new systems in place to distribute the money. But
over the last couple of weeks, I've seen a big ramp up of programs starting over the entire country.
There are now nearly 400 rent relief programs accepting applications, says Andrew Arendt at the National Low Income Housing Coalition.
Every state has opened their program except for New York, and then the others are either county or city programs.
But there are still a lot of barriers to getting money out quickly, he says. For one, most applications require a lot of documentation from tenants. And
many programs won't provide assistance to a tenant if their landlord refuses to participate.
Even if the tenant applies and is eligible. The Treasury Department just changed its guidance on that. So going forward, programs will be required to help tenants who qualify, even if their landlords won't participate. The city of Philadelphia has gone even further. Landlords there can't evict tenants until they've applied to the city for rent relief. Vincent Reyna with the Housing Initiative at Penn says that provides
the opportunity for the city to then determine whether the household's eligible and offer resources to help cure the back rent that's owed.
And Reyna says that is likely to keep more people in their homes. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Also on the topic of rent, as we just were, we started following some people at the beginning of this thing to hear what they are spending their money on and how they were making their rent as the pandemic turned this labor market upside down. Maria Barrios is in Brooklyn. She was waitressing and working as a barista until the restaurant she was working at closed. She collected unemployment for a couple of months till she found a new restaurant job. Here is what she's up to now.
It was actually a great restaurant. I had such a great time. Everybody there was, you know, so nice. It was a very close group of people working together. We didn't have indoor dining, which I don't think anybody really wanted back in winter. But because we had outdoor dining only, we got hit really bad. It was just too cold to sit, even like we had heat lamps and a roof. But even for me, like serving, I still had to wear a coat. We didn't have any reservations and we had like one person dining. They would be like, okay, like you can go home now. And so I would clock out at 3 hours instead of like eight. They're like, we don't really need to pay you right now. Like, why are you on the clock? And so it was a bit unstable, like paycheck to paycheck was very unstable. I couldn't really figure out, it's like, okay, do I go back on unemployment? It was very stressful and like I was so anxious. I didn't know if I could like keep the restaurant job. So I just started looking for jobs and I got an office job offer and I just took it. I had been in service in New York City for like around 5 years. Having an office job is really tiring for some reason. I don't cook as much as I used to. So like I was unemployed. And so then I would, you know, spend probably my day cooking. My meals were more expensive than, you know, working at a restaurant because that's where I got fed. But it wasn't as expensive as like, oh, I'm really hungry and I don't have time to make myself a meal. So I'm just going to seamless something for $25. I guess it's lonely, you know, especially like remote. Yeah, it felt like I didn't really have coworkers, even though, you know, they're on Zoom. And I'm just like, oh, okay, like, it's hard to feel part of a team, I think. I guess when you're at an office, but also, like, more so when it's remote.
Broadway comes back in September. For theater fans and the theater industry, not a moment too soon. Over in the UK, British theaters are already open. Kinda. 50% capacity and masks. For now, those restrictions go away, though, in late June. Welcome news to an industry that employs 300,000 people and sells 34 million tickets a year. Stephen Beard spent some time with a touring theater company last year when things were bad. Virus-wise, he went back out on the road the other day.
For Adrian McDougall, founder of the Black Eyed Touring Theatre Group, the pandemic has been a financial disaster.
We haven't toured at all since March 2020. As a touring company, been a big blow. Big blow.
But don't expect a tale of unmitigated woe.
I've never been busier, oddly enough, finding new ways of working.
He's taken his theatre company online. He's filmed a number of his productions, including this pre-pandemic tour favourite, the gothic horror story, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
I battered, I kicked, I gouged, I crushed, and I enjoyed it.
It's available on demand, proving that all the world's a stage. The production was downloaded last month for a special screening in a cabaret bar in Shanghai.
I feel really proud that people have... in China, have paid to go and see our work in a venue during a pandemic.
And it seems they can't get enough of it. After the gothic horror of Jekyll and Hyde, next month in Shanghai they'll be getting the gothic romance of Jane Eyre.
Do you think because I am poor, plain and little, I have no soul, no heart?
McDougall admits his online productions haven't made up for the loss of revenue from the live touring. But along with his reserves and some government money, it's helped the company stay afloat during the pandemic. Meanwhile, his actors have been juggling multiple roles, as usual.
Actors have always been very good at adapting to different situations, different work.
Ashley Sean Cook has a part in Jekyll and Hyde and has just started playing the children's character the Gruffalo in another company's production. Ironically, the pandemic has helped him survive financially. He's been working as a door-to-door COVID tester.
So at the moment, I work 5 days a week swabbing and doing capillary bloods on people's doorsteps. And then at the weekends, I perform as the Gruffalo. So it's a bit of a mix at the moment.
Huh? I'm going to have lunch with the... Gruffalo!
Of course, actors were struggling long before the pandemic. According to a recent survey, 90% of them in the UK are usually unemployed. But Luke Barton, who plays Sherlock Holmes in a Black Eyed production, says the pandemic has made matters a lot worse.
All my actor friends have had to turn to other things. I mean, whether that's delivery driving, working in supermarkets, anything like that.
His co-star in the Sherlock Holmes production trained as a paramedic, and so he's now working part-time giving anti-COVID shots.
I'm hoping that any day now I should have my vaccine administered by Dr. Watson. If you want anyone to administer your vaccine, it's surely Dr. Watson.
Barton supported himself with part-time teaching and narrating audiobooks, a medium that's boomed here during the pandemic. But he and the rest of the company can't wait to get back to live theatre. Black Eyed is due to hit the road for a 9-month comeback tour starting in September. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, this item from Costco, the food courts there are coming back. No, it's not fine dining, it's churros and frozen yogurt, pizzas, also hot dogs, but it is more normal, right? Also, inside the store, those free sample stations are going to be coming back. I personally might pass on those. All right, we got to go, but here is your moment of economic context, courtesy of the United States Postal Service. You know all those complaints we've been hearing about slower deliveries and closed post offices? Yeah, they're going to start costing more. The post office said today it is asking for a bump in first-class stamps, 55 cents to 58, effective August 29th. That is if approved by the Postal Regulatory Commission. I guess they get to decide. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you Monday, everybody. Have a great long weekend. If you're working Monday, thank you. And also, think about what that day is for, would you? Because that's important. We'll see you Monday. This is APM.